Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 42 of the Wrestling Culture Podcast with Dave Musgrave here, along with co-host Dylan Hales. Dylan, how you doing?
I'm in a tropical storm.
Excellent.
Well, I mean, it isn't hitting yet, but people who listen to this show will probably be used to weird outside noises coming from my end of the line, because if you're a longtime listener, you know I get expelled from the house whenever I do a show. Tonight, I'm not totally expelled from the house. I'm on my porch, but it's pouring down rain, and it would be anywhere I am in the house be super loud, so forgive me for the fact that it's pouring down rain, because there's really no way to muffle that entirely on audio. Just deal with it, and we can pretend that I'm a storm chaser, because we will be getting hit with a tropical storm here in Charleston in a couple of days, so... supposedly. Who knows?
Wouldn't it be a really fun reality show for you and I to actually be storm chasers? Like, instead of being really into wrestling, we're doing crazy shit like that.
Oh, my God. Well, you know, it's funny because I think you, like, one of the big differences is, you know, when I lived in New Jersey, I remember the first time it snowed. And the first time it snowed was actually the worst time it snowed during the several years I lived up there. And it was like 2 feet of snow. But by the time it hit 2 inches, I was like, how the fuck do people live in this? Because we don't ever get snow down here. You know, to me, 2 inches may as well have been like the absolute worst blizzard in recorded history. Like, I couldn't understand how society functions. But then,
whereas
you know,
I'm like, oh man, that sounds easy to shovel.
Yes, exactly. To you, it's like nothing. Like, that's it. But conversely, like Jen's mom, my wife's mom, she still lives in New Jersey, and, you know, whenever she sees on the news that, like, a tropical storm is near us or tropical depression, I'm like, look, I lived through Hurricane Hugo as a kid. I've been hit by tons of tropical storms and things of that nature over the years. We don't even worry about it until it gets to be, like, a Category 3 hurricane.
That's what she says?
No, that's what I say. You know, she's panicking, like, if it's within, like, 500 miles of us. To me, it's like, eh, whatever. Until it's a Category 3, we don't care. I just care about my side room flooding. Other than that, I don't give a shit.
I kind of like when there's a hurricane comes through. I mean, I don't get it that often, and we certainly don't get them as bad as you, but they're kind of cool.
Yeah, I mean, we lived through, here in Charleston, through one of the, probably, I'd say, definitely top 10, if not top 5 worst hurricane disasters in modern U.S. history in 89.
So that's not good. That's obviously
Hurricane Hugo. Well, no, it was great, dude. It was actually awesome because I was out of school for 8 weeks, and you could just like rummage around the neighborhood through like random formations that had been formed by, you know, I mean, like, because boats were in people's front yards that had basically sailed down Venice-style rivers that were in the streets that had been created by the storm. So some of these boats have traveled like 20 miles and were like in people's yards in my neighborhood. And when you're a kid, that's like the coolest thing ever. You don't, you know, because you're not paying for the house to get re-roofed, so what the hell do you care?
Yeah.
So actually, for me, it was pretty cool. For most people, I think it was, you know, horrible. But as usual, I'm selfish and don't care about other people.
Exactly.
Speaking of people who are selfish and don't care about now.
I thought about that segue, but, you know, ideally it would be nice if the person even got a chance to listen to it.
No. And I don't actually believe that, by the way. But.
Yeah, no, neither do I. Our topic for tonight is someone that personally I've always been a huge fan of and still am, Mr. Paul Heyman. And I guess on the weekend we were just basically trying to come up with topics, and I thought of him because, I don't know, it just seems really timely. Like, he's such a huge part of WWE right now. And character-wise, on-screen-wise, I don't, you know, it could easily be argued that it's the best work of his career.
Oh, I don't agree with that. But we'll get to that. I don't agree with that at all. But
no?
No, well, you know what? Fuck it. We'll just cover it now. I'm really throwing out the foul language today. I've been even tempered on most of the more recent shows. I'm just letting it fly. I think it's been very good, But I think he benefits a lot in the modern context because of the fact that there's nobody else, like so much to the roster, even guys who are good promos in the modern context, didn't come through the system that Heyman came through. They don't have the roots that he has. A lot of them weren't lifelong fans like he was. They didn't break in the way he does. So if he really comes across, I think, that's not to say, I don't want to sound like I'm slamming him now, because I've enjoyed more than I thought I would of this run, way more, and some of it a whole lot. But I actually think he benefits a lot from the fact that there's very few guys that are strong enough promos, charismatic enough to really match him. And in fact, I think one of the reasons that this isn't his best run, or even close to it as a character performer, is because of the fact that there's nobody to go tit for tat with him. There's nobody good enough, like that they have right now, who can really match him in a promo setting. You know, and that's not his fault.
I think one good exception is that I thought him and Jericho were pretty cool together this week.
I didn't like that at all, but that's just me. Like Jericho's one of these. Like the thing about Jericho is, I think as a wrestler, he's actually had this year, you know, coming back this year has been his best year in several years. But as a character, I just don't think there's a lot of interesting things for him to do. It's not his fault. It's just the nature of the beast.
Yeah. Well, I guess maybe we could talk at some Paul Heyman. What's your first memories of seeing anything about him?
This is actually, you know what? You've got to understand, this is a little bit qualified because it's tough to say with certainty I've always been a guy who collected wrestling magazines. Unfortunately, I don't have hardly any of them anymore, but for years and years I got them. And I even continued to get them for a good while after I was, a newsletter reader and the internet hit.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So I want to say that the first time I heard about Paulie was probably, and we should say that at least in my case, it's going to be hard for me not to call him Heyman, Paulie, dangerously at various points throughout. It's just going to be, because to me it's all the same guy, right? But
yeah,
I think the first time I heard about him or remember seeing him was probably the stuff in, I guess it was 88 and 89, in the NWA WCW.
Okay.
Which would have been the Samoan SWAT team, if I'm not mistaken. And before that, the feud with the Midnight Express.
Yeah, where he was in with the original Midnight Express.
Yes, which I actually remember seeing, and I think I saw it live because I watched all the stuff live back then as a kid, 6:05 every week for sure. But,
well, and part of the qualifier here too is that you were born in like 81, right?
I was born in 81. But I have vivid memories about a lot of stuff I saw in wrestling at a very young age. I have a memory of seeing that, but I can't remember. I mean, in all likelihood, I saw that at the time. But the real lasting effect for him, I think, because the SST stuff, and then the stuff with the Dangerous Alliance a couple years later. Not that I want to skip his early career. In fact, I want to talk even earlier than this. But this is kind of the stuff that I remember. As like my gateway to him as a character. And I will also, my point in mentioning the magazines is, I remember probably, it had to have been 89 or 90. The magazines would reference things that had happened, that he did in the Memphis feud in 87, which was really his first big break with Tommy Rich and Austin Idol and all that angle. So, the point is that this all gets jumbled in my head. I can't remember what I saw first, what I knew first. The first real big lasting effect, though, probably would have been 89. How about you?
Well, for me, like in 1987, I was still just watching WWF, but my cousin was collecting PWI, and it got started to get into NWA through that. And I remember looking at the 1987 PWI year-end issue and going through those unofficial official awards and seeing something about him there. I very specifically remember that. And then it was halfway through 88 when I started following, reading those magazines and watching NWA as well. And so I would read about him. But then, yeah, I knew of him, and then what I first saw of him was when he came in with the original Midnights. I mean, AWA was on TSN up here at the time, but it was still a pay channel, and we didn't get it. So
sure, yeah.
Yeah. So my first time, I guess, I ever saw actual footage of him would have been, and I watched the show live, Starrcade 88. And it was the original Midnights versus the actual Midnights. And we didn't get it on TV. I actually went to my cousin's place and watched it on satellite dish. So I had no idea that they were even in there at the time until the pay-per-view was airing live.
That's crazy.
Yeah. So, I mean, actually, that used to happen for me a lot. Cause I was only up to date with PWI. And
Which was 3-4, sometimes 6 months behind, depending.
It was usually about 2. And, that's how up to date I'd be. And then, I remember, like, Chi-Town Rumble is one of my favorite pay-per-views of all time. And I'd had some indication that Steamboat might be coming in there, but didn't know until I got the tape that my cousin taped just on a whim for me, right? And I didn't know until I started watching the show that's what the match was going to be, him and Flair. So
that's kind of funny. But that happened to all of us back then too, though. You know.
Yeah.
In fact,
a lot of people were up to date with TV at least. So
that's true. That's true. Yeah. But it was a different world. That's all I'll say. Is that it was a way different world. It really was up until the internet, frankly.
Yeah. So that was the first thing I saw of him, was that match. And I just remember, that legend. To me, it's legendary seeing Cornette coming down and saying he's going to give a Christmas present to the NWA and kick that little punk's ass. and, the first time seeing, actually, it was my first time seeing Cornette as a babyface. So,
I was just going to say that Cornette and Heyman are, I think they're forever probably going to be linked to each other, whether the other likes it or not.
Yeah. Well, they're like opposite sides of the same coin,
Yep. Yep. I totally agree with that. In a variety of ways, I agree with that. But, that stuff. I mean, the original Midnight's Feud, the way it was executed, the way the angle was done on TBS, all that stuff was really awesome. The shitty thing is that it didn't last. It lasted for a while, but it's a shame that didn't really get to go around the horn more. Of course, the flip side to that argument is Cornette is a guy you ideally want as a heel. So how long can you have what effectively, at the end of the day, was a heel versus heel feud? Because neither Midnight Express was going to be a babyface team long term. Period. So I guess that's kind of the flip side of that argument. But that's the execution of that angle and the development of that feud was really great. And that's what put Heyman on the map nationally, I guess. What put him on the map was the angle with Austin Idol and Tommy Rich and the cage match in 87 in Memphis. That's really the what put him on the map as a manager of note, and not just a random guy that was in the business. Even to this day, I think that is probably one of the more talked about Memphis angles of the 80s. Maybe the most talked about, actually. I don't know if there was a Memphis angle in the PWI magazines that was ever treated quite the same way that angle was treated.
Well, the only other angle that could be equal to it would probably surpasses it, honestly, is Lawler Kaufman.
Yes, yeah, yeah. that probably would
that,
be right.
I mean, that's one of the biggest angles anywhere, you know.
Yeah. Anyway, I want to go back even farther than this, Dave, because one of the things that I think is fascinating about Heyman, and this is the same again, like you can say the exact same thing about Cornette, is the way he broke into the business.
Love it.
Because here was just this guy who was a teenager walking around, you know, taking pictures in Madison Square Garden. He was just a fan. And if I'm not mistaken, I know I listened to the show he did with Dave Meltzer after Captain Lou Albano passed away. And I know, I want to say, they made him show up to get his press pass because he called and gotten a hold of Vince Sr. And then he showed up to get his press pass. I want to say it was Arnold Skolin who he had to get the best press pass from. He actually showed up at office to get it, maybe. And I'm sure these people are thinking, what the fuck? How did this kid con his way into getting a press pass? But
yeah.
that's how he got into the business, was as a photographer and sort of, you know, a guy that would just show up at the Garden and take pictures of the stars, so to speak. And that was his in into the wrestling world. To me, that's just totally fascinating. And then from there, to basically be the I'm sure he wouldn't like this term, but I don't really give a shit. To basically be the way he portrays it is almost the gopher for the Three Wise Men.
I would have liked to have been the gopher for the Three Wise Men.
There are definitely I imagine that would have been pretty awesome, because you've got some interesting characters there. And I know he was close with Albano particularly, but some interesting, very interesting characters there. And, you know, it's funny because when you look at those guys who were obviously an integral part of the New York territory, I mean, it's hard to even fathom how much, because all the heels were paired with them, all of them.
Yeah, they were the top heels, essentially. They were the consistent top heels. You know.
That's right. Well, they were the anchors, exactly. They were the anchors of the heel side of things. But it's weird, because even though I know Heyman would say that those guys, to some degree, influenced them in various ways, probably particularly Albano, I don't really think Heyman stylistically has very many similarities at all to those guys. I mean, I'm
maybe
sure
to the maybe to the Grand Wizard a bit.
Maybe a little. To me, that's actually one of the most fascinating things about Heyman as a on-air character, is the fact that he was there with these guys. He was at least theoretically going to be learning from these guys to some degree. Whether the intention was for him to ever break in or not is really irrelevant. You're going to pick up things when you're with them. But he doesn't. I mean, not only is he not a clone of any of those guys, I don't really think he's all that similar to any of them as an on-air character. You know, to me, he was a. I think that might be the coolest thing about him, actually, as an on-air figure, is that he was completely unique as a manager. I don't really think he was very similar to anybody else.
No, and so good at so young an age.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. He benefited a lot, probably, again, though, from being there at such a young age backstage and at least having whatever limited presence he had in the belly of the beast in New York around these guys. That whole time period is really, it's really fascinating to me that anybody could get into the business that way, because I just can't even envision such a scenario like that ever happening now. And yet Heyman and Cornette both basically got their break the same way, in different places. You know,
I mean, and at the same time, you know, it could be argued that people have more opportunity to do that now with being able to have a voice on the internet.
Oh yeah, I think it is easier to
have some visibility, you know.
To have visibility, and it's also easier to break into the business as a wrestler now, because there's wrestling schools. Now there's fewer places to work that where you can make money, but there's, you know, but in terms of, like, I mean, I can't see. I mean, there's no weekly loop, right? So you can't just show up to a weekly arena and say, can I take pictures? I mean, what weekly arena? Nobody runs any place. So there's, you know, I mean, I guess that could have happened at the Impact Zone. But maybe that's how Jesse Neal got a job. But I don't know. It's just, it's kind of crazy to think that that was actually a viable option. And not only was it a viable option, but two of the most important and biggest managers in wrestling history took that option basically at the same time. That's really crazy.
And I think the other aspect to it is it wasn't all that viable an option. I just think these guys were so determined to get in one way, come hell or high water, too, right?
Maybe. I mean, I think
knowing them as personally well as I do, anyways.
Well, I think the thing is, both guys too, they're both so crazy charismatic. I can imagine them even being charismatic as kids. And I mean,
yeah.
Heyman, and I don't think this is an unfair thing to say about him, you know. And I mean, the guy is as carny as it gets. I mean, like,
yeah.
I
think you probably, at least partially, mean that as a compliment, too.
Oh, I actually 100% mean that as a compliment in the wrestling business. I mean, Christ, you have to do that. That's one of the things, like, and this is going to be a mild segue, but talking about the, you know, like, the big thing that happened with Chikara and the angle and everything that happened this past week, like, I've been talking about it in various venues, and I think people, like, I mean, I've been kind of, I mean, personally, I'd be really irritated by it if I was a Chikara fan. I'm not, thankfully, so I don't have any personal investment in it. But I actually give Quackenbush a lot of credit for being such a great carny that he's got a company that is canceled, that set up fake shows, canceled them, had a WCW NWO era level finish to their what is ostensibly their last night pay per view, and people are applauding it as the greatest booking ever. I mean, if that's like not Heyman-esque, I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
I still
don't even know what really happened.
Well, nobody does. I mean, that's part of it. And I don't want to go on to a long silly about that. In fact, maybe we could do a show about that whole situation this coming week if you wanted to. I'd be willing to do that because that probably deserves an entire show. But with maybe somebody who's more versed in Chikara than me. But my point is, if you know, in this business, you have to, in the wrestling business, this business, like I'm in it, but you have to do what you can to survive.
In my hood.
You have to do what you can to survive. You have to do what you can to thrive. You have to do what you can to stay relevant. And you have to be able to do things that people will question morally or people will think are a little bit shady, or you have to lie, cheat, and steal, I guess would be the way to put it. And you can argue to what degree Heyman did those three things, but I don't think you can argue that he did. I mean, he certainly did those things.
I don't think the NWA angle in 1994, I don't think he entered into that thinking, oh, nobody's going to be mad at this, you know.
Well, I mean, even going back, I mean, the famous story in 87 where somehow he pissed off Lawler enough where Lawler punched him and broke his jaw. I mean, I don't remember the backstory as to what he had done to piss off Lawler enough to do that. But, you know, the story is that Lawler did it on purpose. That's what Lawler claims, anyway.
I think probably the fact that he was in his late teens, early 20s, and he wasn't female.
Lawler would have just smacked his ass if he had been a female. So to me, like, you know, this guy is super charismatic. He probably had the charisma from the very beginning, which really helped him get his in. And then where was the first place he worked? Was the first place he worked in Florida as a manager?
That was kind of his first place that had any kind of real...
I mean, I know he did indies in the north, like kind of outlaw.
Yeah, yeah.
Indies
so
and stuff in the
so basically he... Yeah, and, you know, I did do some Googling for this people as well, so this is the stuff that I've always known. But basically, what I did know before previously as well is that he had worked at Studio 54 in the
yes.
mid-'80s, in the version, that era's version of Studio 54. And basically, when that closed up, you know, he'd been a lifelong wrestling fan, used to go to MSG, used to work at MSG, you know, because he used to go back and hang out with the managers. When the Studio 54 wrapped up, he started working as manager on the Northeast Circuit. And apparently, I mean, I guess he was a backstage presence. And what I read is that it was kind of a dare from Bam Bam Bigelow to give Heyman a shot as a manager. It's like, let's see if that can work. And sure enough, you know, so he starts managing. And from there, you know, ends up going down to Florida in early 87 and being hooked up with down there, he got hooked up with Humperdinck.
Yep.
And, yeah, he was associated mostly with Humperdinck, and I think with Sullivan as well. So, yeah, he went down there, and then eventually, and he worked a lot with a guy who, you know, isn't necessarily famously associated with him, but in late 1990, he had a guy come back into WCW who was known as the Motor City Madman, and he had actually worked with him down in Florida, and I think in the Northeast Circuit as well. And that is a guy who, I don't know if you managed to watch enough of the Montreal stuff that I sent you to get this, but he was known as Man Mountain Moore there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I think it was Mark Moore or Michael. I think it was Mark Moore, not Michael Moore. That would be interesting. and, yeah, so he actually had a tag team with him, and possibly, it looks from the pictures that it might have even actually been 911, but some people debate that it was. But he was in a tag team called the Motor City Madmen, and he managed them, I think, around the Northeast and then some down in Florida. And then he ended up going into Memphis and having the stuff with Austin Idol and Tommy Rich, which was really cool that they referenced that on Raw just recently.
Yeah, absolutely. I thought that was neat. I like when they do any of that old school referencing of stuff. But
that's actually really, really what makes having JBL and Lawler on commentary a really cool atmosphere there, is that they will do that stuff.
Yeah, of course, with JBL, you know you're going to get stuff like 47 references to the Simpson brothers.
Yeah.
But if you can wade through his torrid love affair for the Simpsons, I don't know, maybe yes. Well, never mind, I don't want to say that.
Okay. But when it doesn't pass through the Dylan Hales filter, you know it must have been filthy.
It was bad. I had to stop. I had to stop myself from going there. But anyway, on that note,
I will confess to something. I have the Memphis set, but I have not seen the stuff with Heyman there from 87. I haven't gotten to that yet.
It's good. I think the problem there is that Jimmy Hart is the god of 80s. Really, Jimmy Hart at his peak, it might be the best manager ever. I mean, only Heenan, I think, is a legitimate contender to overtake him. And I'm a pretty big Cornette fan. But I think in a way...
Without comparing him to Hart, I mean, my understanding is it was pretty damn good.
Well, it's very good, but the problem is it's impossible not to compare him to Hart if you're watching the whole set.
because
all that stuff is right there, you know what I mean? Like, but having said that, one of the things that made him such a cool thing is that he's, you know, this spoiled New York kid with his cell phone when nobody had a cell phone, coming down to the South.
I love that. Yeah.
Being a douchebag. I mean, he was the reason he succeeded is because of Southern animus toward Yankees and him being the stereotypical Yankee. I mean, the fact that he was Jewish, frankly, I think, let's just be honest, just added to it. I mean, there's no question. Like, I mean, I think it would have worked regardless of his ethnic composition, whatever the hell term you want to use.
Well, it's not like he was billed as such.
It was heavily implied, and he may have actually been billed as such at times. It was heavily implied. I mean, it was a stereotype that he was working, okay?
Yeah.
And he was working.
Keep in mind that I grew up with, like, no Jewish people at the time, so I didn't know the stereotype.
He was working your stereotypical, you know, I mean, people use the term yuppie. I don't know that that's even the best term to describe it. To me, it was obvious, especially obvious in hindsight, he was working the stereotypical, like, anti-Semitic stereotype of, you know, shyster New York Jew businessman. So that, like, that was basically, like, in its early incarnation, the businessman thing may have been slightly more subtle because he was a young kid and how effective could this guy be in the business world or whatever. But, like, he, you know, that was clearly,
he definitely came off as the guy who was trying to get by on his dad's trust fund.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. So,
which is ironic since he probably was. and bravo for him. I wish I had been able to do so.
Oh, God. No kidding.
Yeah.
But.
Yeah, and I guess one of the other things to reference is just where the name Polly Dangerously even came from. Do you remember the movie, Johnny Dangerously?
Yes.
Yeah, I love that movie. So that kind of made me get a real kick out of him, too. But yeah, that was a Michael Keaton movie in the 80s where basically Heyman looks a lot like Michael Keaton does in that movie and probably acts a lot like him, too. and, you know, it was basically Johnny Dangerously was a kid who got into the organized crime, kind of a comedy version of Goodfellas, I guess.
Yes, and, I think that's a relatively reasonable comparison.
Yeah, and it was pretty funny stuff. It was really good 80s stuff, and, you know, Heyman played off that character, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then, I mean, from there, he did the Florida stuff, and then he came into the AWA, and not a lot Express came up. Just one sec. Someone called me for Ann, but she's not home, and I'm on the line. So, not a lot of the Midnight Express stuff came up on the AWA set, but, you know, I think they were a pretty fun tag team. And
oh, yeah, absolutely.
They, I guess, why don't you talk about what you remember of them in the AWA?
I mean, the thing is, like, to me, I just like the idea of Polly Dangerously negotiating with Vern Gagne in 1988. Or 87,
yeah.
Whatever the hell it was. Like, that just makes me laugh, just the thought of it. Like, I mean, nobody at that point was really making a mark in the AWA, because at that point, the AWA was past the point of no return. I mean, you can argue about when the point of no return was in the AWA. I mean, that's an argument. But you can't argue that it wasn't already well past that point by then. I mean, they were well past the tipping point. So, to me, that was just a place where he got experience. And, yes, the original Midnight Express were a good team. They had some good matches there. But the only thing from that era of the AWA that really stands out is the stuff, you know, with Kurt Hennig from 87 and 88 before he leaves. Everything else, you know, there's some good stuff. There's some fun stuff. There's some entertaining things here or there. But nobody really stands out because nobody was designed to stand out. I mean, like, in hindsight, it's almost kind of weird that they even brought him in. Now, I believe he also managed Adrian Adonis at that point. And,
yes, I think he managed Adonis and Orton.
Yes, yeah, he absolutely did, actually. And now you talk about a team that could have been awesome if they'd stuck together. But nobody was really designed to get over as big stars at that point. I should probably amend that. Nobody was going to. I'm sure Vern thought he was on to something with various people, but I'm sure a combination of financial reasons, practicality, the fact that people saw the writing on the wall, nobody stayed for any length of time, including those guys. So, to me, that's...
Yeah, and there's a lot of co-promoting, say, there was a lot of co-promoting with Memphis and whatnot, so.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think, to me, that's a real blip on the Heyman radar screen, mainly relevant because it was another run for the original Midnight Express, you know, and in theory, that was the first time that he was on national television, in theory. Now, I don't know how many people were watching it, but in theory, that was the first time that he had a national television presence, or at least the first time I can think that.
I thought you were arguing about whether or not earlier stuff was national, and really you were just arguing about whether or not AWA was still national.
Yes. Yeah. You know,
it does look like the Rose and Condry with Heyman formed in the AWA.
I think that's right.
Yeah.
I don't. You know, they may have worked. They may were they? Did they? No, I don't think they did anything in Continental. This is part of the problem, folks, is that I'm a terrible researcher and I do everything off memory.
Yeah. Well, but it was the next year, I think, that they did some stuff in Memphis. But I think they started in the AWA together.
Yeah.
And the next year they were in Memphis and Windy City Pro Wrestling. Where else were they? I think they might have been in Continental during that year.
I want to say they did something in Continental, but I honestly don't remember off the top of my head. But the point is, these are like all Dying Days territories. I mean, even Windy City, that's a fascinating little existing group. But all that stuff of Dying Days stuff, but all that stuff I think is important because Heyman is one of the last guys who really got the full experience in terms of territory development because he worked in the Northeast. That's where he started. You know, then he worked down south in Florida. Then he worked for the AWA, which was at least theoretically a national promotion. They ran a lot of shows in various places over a pretty broad space. Although I don't know how many dates he worked outside of Las Vegas, the TV tape.
Windy City might not seem like all that relevant a promotion on the national stage, history of the national stage, it is relevant in his career because I believe it's the first time he ever got the chance to be a booker.
Yeah.
Or at least a distant booker.
Yeah. And Chicago's a big city. The thing is, he worked a lot of places for a guy who got in right as everything was falling off the map. You know, I mean, he worked a lot of places. And that probably, I think that may be one of the reasons why he's been such a survivor. Like, every time you think, well, that's the last time we'll see him, he still finds another way to have to remain relevant and have a job. It's because when he broke into the business, he was basically going from dying promotion to dying promotion and trying to find a way to stay relevant and keep a job. So he mastered that technique very early because he had no choice. All that timeline is really fascinating. Obviously, the Midnight versus original Midnight feud is really fascinating. One thing I love is Great American Bash 89, one of the best pay-per-views of all time. And you know what? Paul Lee and Jim Cornette had a pretty good tuxedo match.
They sure did. Arguably the greatest tuxedo match there's been.
That was a pretty good match. I mean, nobody's going to mistake it for being an all-time classic. But it was pretty darn good for two guys.
It's not. But
yeah, and especially because Heyman was not a guy that you thought of as a big bump-taking manager. You know, I mean, that's another thing that sort of sets him apart is when you think of the big managers from the 80s that are kind of have like sort of an iconic stature to them from the 70s and 80s, outside of New York, maybe this is one thing he learned from New York, because none of those guys took bumps. But the other guys you think of, Jimmy Hart, Bobby Heenan, Jim Cornette, those guys are like epic bump takers, you know, like all of them are. And he wasn't. You know, I mean, it's not that he didn't ever take bumps, but I don't think of Paul Lee as a guy who did. So that's another reason I think that match is all the more impressive, is because you don't think of him as a physical manager, as a guy who was often getting, you know, whipped around and thrown around every night like those other people were. So, you know, kudos to him and Cornette for stealing
as much as we might say it's not like Misawa Kobashi or Misawa Kawada or anything like that, if two non-performers were going to try and have a tuxedo match or any kind of like non-performer match to emulate, that would be the one. And
yeah,
not just
yeah, it was really
good for non-performers, it's really good match of that kind of genre, you know.
Absolutely agree. Really good match. I like it a lot. One of my favorite things to laugh at when I was a kid, too, when I was when I had the tape, I used to watch that match a lot because I thought it was funny. So that's which was kind of the point. So.
And so 88, he came into Windy City, and he did have the chance to be. He had the chance to be, you know, do some booking there. And he did go, after the AWA, yeah, they did go to Continental. And he particularly was allied with Eddie Gilbert there.
That's right. See, I'm not an idiot.
So I was wrong. Continental was actually his first chance to be a booker, because Gilbert was the head booker and Heyman was his...
But see, Continental at that point, and man, I wish Chris Donner was here because he would know right away. Like, but Continental at that point, that was
the Road to Birmingham era.
Yeah, but that was also during that period where, like, I want to say Continental was going through Booker super fast during that era. But then again, Eddie Gilbert was never anywhere long. That was right.
Yeah,
the never anywhere long, but yeah, that Continental is was that kind of an important stop for Heyman because of that, and because, you know, the Eddie deal is sort of foreshadowing for what would happen a few years later.
Yeah. So yeah, sorry. Yeah, we did forget that initially, and yeah, he went to Continental that year, and yeah, I remember that's when I first started with the Aftermags, and I remember following the Road to Birmingham stuff and. They made a pretty big deal out of it, you know. I remember it was sponsored by a chewing tobacco company, and and they had a tournament for the title that ended up being won by Tom Pritchard, if I recall. That was the first time I'd really heard of Tom Pritchard, and yeah, so you know that was pretty cool stuff. And there, from there, he segued into Windy City, and I think he was probably doing both at the same time. I don't think know that Windy City was doing a full loop at the time. But that's where he was first a head booker. And, you know, I'm reading right from what I plagiarized from the internet here. But he basically got a reputation there as an innovative television writer and producer. And he lost a ton of money on a show in September 1988 that had Bam Bam Bigelow versus Terry Bam Bam Gordy. So it sucks that they lost a lot of money, but, you know.
Well,
it's cool to watch someone put on a good product even if they lose their ass.
We should be clear. I think kind of the story of Paul Heyman's career is guy who puts on good or interesting product that doesn't make money.
Yeah.
Or kind of like guy who's involved in like interesting stuff that doesn't make money. I mean, that sounds like an asshole thing to say, except for the fact that it's basically entirely true.
Well, I mean, what better proof is there than, you know, bankruptcy? And,
yeah,
I honestly do think, like, with so much of ECW, he was just a little ahead of his time, and then the times caught up with him, and other people were doing it too.
Okay, there is a lot of stuff I'm going to say about ECW when we get there. So, in fact, like, the bulk of the stuff I have to say about Heyman, it starts with, like, the Dangerous Alliance and goes through there. So we're almost there. So, you know what? Walk us through the relevant stuff before that point, because at that point I'm going to not shut up, and you're going to want to cut my non-existent mic.
So 88, he and the original Midnights go to WCW. I remember built up the Chi-Town Rumble where they had the guy who gets pinned has to leave the company.
Yeah.
Dennis Condrey wasn't in the match. I think it was Jack Victory as the Russian assassin replaced him, and then Randy Rose got pinned and somehow became an inspirational wrestler as promoted by PWI. But from there, Heyman brought in the Samoan SWAT team, going after the Lane and Eaton, who left for a little while, but when they came back, it built up to a fun feud. And Heyman was
They had an awesome match
at
Halloween Havoc 89, if I'm not mistaken.
What's that?
I want to say they had an awesome match at Halloween Havoc 89. Am I right on that? Like, there was one...
I'll tell you in a moment.
There was one match that those two teams had, and I thought it was at Halloween Havoc 89, where, like, Bobby Eaton took, like, four or five completely insane bumps, and the SST was just working stiff, even by SST standards, which is saying something. Yeah. Because they always work stiff. Was Halloween Havoc 89?
I'll be there in a moment.
Okay. But I see, that's probably my first really memories of Heyman is during this period, because I remember thinking that he was, I mean, obviously as a kid, I'm not thinking this is the perfect act, because that's not how I viewed wrestling as a kid. But I do remember thinking that,
I do picture you watching him and aspiring to be him, though.
I do remember thinking that he was like just the right jerk to be managing the Samoan Swan.
Yeah,
I don't even know how to really frame it because I was so young. But
that's what he was going for. So it's by no means an insult, right?
I specifically remember thinking that I don't want to say they were cool because I hated them because I was a kid, but I specifically remember thinking that and really getting into their matches, for lack of a better term. They hooked me in the way that heels are supposed to hook you as a kid, like big time. So.
So at Halloween Havoc 1990, it was the Samoan SWAT team as a six-man team with Samoan Savage coming in, who used to be Tama or the Tonga Kid, and they took on the Midnight Express and Steve Williams.
That's right. Yep. Okay. Yeah. That's exactly the match I'm talking about. Okay. Thank you. Anyway.
So from there, you go into 1990. I don't know how long they kept him with the Midnights, but I know in 1990 he ended up out. No, with the SST. I mean, I know in 1990 he ended up. He did some managing. He did some announcing, I guess, as well. And then
or at least it seemed like a lot at the time as a kid, because that was when that was the period where he started to have a presence, because even with the SST, it's not that he was an undercard act, because I mean he was, but it wasn't until he became an announcer or, you know, was in the commentary booth that he started to feel like a bigger deal, at least to me as a kid.
Yeah.
That's when he seemed like he was a bigger deal. Even though I may not have even been with a team at the time or anybody in particular for all I can remember. But I just remember thinking, you know, in my mind, like as a kid, the people who have the more time on TV or you hear their voice more, they seem like bigger deals.
And then he ended up out of WCW for a little while, and he actually ended up working in ICW, the Savoldi's promotion. And my impression is that he was actually booker there as well. And the big thing he did is he managed the Lethal Weapons of Dennis Condrey and Doug Gilbert, and they became tag champs, winning the belts from Vic Steamboat and Phil Apollo.
Now, here's the question we all want to know. Were they real tag belts or were they cardboard?
There's actually a promo you can see on YouTube, I think, of Heyman standing with the belts, and it's like actually like a really good promo. That's like really kind of wasted on a promotion like that, but he was going for it, baby.
Got to stay relevant. Got to stay relevant and survive the story of Paul Heyman.
A for effort, you know. So.
That's right.
And, you know, I always thought that was really cool that I remember seeing about that in PWI again, you know, like that he had Dennis Condrey and Doug Gilbert as a tag team. And that just, I don't know, that just seemed like a really cool combination. So,
yep.
There he ends up back in WCW and ends up managing Mark Callis, a.k.a. The Undertaker, after he ended up out of after the Skyscrapers were finished. And I loved that act together. Callis, whatever the hell you want to call him at that point. I really liked him as a singles wrestler and thought Heyman complimented him well. And all the squash matches were great. And then leading up to the match with Luger for the U.S. title, the Great American Bash, I thought it was fantastic stuff.
That's when he was using the heart punch finish, right?
Yep, and when he was really, really doing the very cool rope walking.
Yep.
I think that's the best rope walking of his career, because he was actually walking without holding the other guy's arm or anything like that, and he was doing the heat seeker elbow drop.
Yep, I remember that.
Yeah, which a few years later, when my buddy was at my place and on the phone to his mom, he wasn't too happy when he turned around and got a heat seeker from me right in the face. Supposed to be a clothesline, but unfortunately, since he turned around, it ended up being, I just decked him right in the face.
at least you didn't give him a heart punch.
No. Yeah. Maybe next time I see him, though. Yeah, and then I think he was kind of quiet until the end of the year. He ended up managing, the Motor City Madman came in, and he ended up managing him and Curtis Hughes in this, like, I don't know. It's really weird to think they actually did this, but basically they took on the United Skyscrapers of Sid Vicious and Danny Spivey at Starrcade 1990. And, I know, I remember the Skyscrapers were over pretty huge that night. So, he ended up fired for part of 1991, and I don't know that he went anywhere else, but, it was in late 1991, most of 1991, actually, now that I think of what he was doing commentary, and it was in late 1991 where he did what probably most people would consider some of his most fun stuff when he formed the Dangerous Alliance.
Oh, that's the best. That's the best wrestling stable ever, in my opinion.
Yeah.
In the ring, as a cohesive act, both in the ring, promos, overall presence, it's the best wrestling stable I ever saw.
I saw a lot
of them, by the way.
I guess we can't assume that everyone knows everything about them.
No.
But basically, Heyman was fired. And then the angle was that he somehow angled himself back to be on be still part of the company through legal means. And he ended up becoming a manager. And at Halloween Havoc 1991, they had some interesting stuff on that show, actually. And one of the things they did was they built the Halloween Phantom against the Z-Mad, Tom Zink, which I was talking on Will's podcast the other night how, man, I hated that name. But
Tom Zink's the biggest dick I've ever met in wrestling, by the way. But that's a different story.
Oh, really?
Not
you mean like,
not he had
I assume
the
you mean like
dick.
Not a nice person, and not how the other way that.
Yes,
could.
Not he had the biggest dick.
Okay.
No, he huge asshole. Yeah.
Really? Okay.
Yep. Easy. Not even close. No, I mean I can't. I mean far worse than Ole Anderson, and I have met Ole, so. yeah.
Well, maybe he deserved that. Maybe he deserved that horrible name then.
Enough about that horrible piece of shit.
And deserved the job to the Halloween Phantom, who ended up being Rick Rude under a mask, who hadn't been on TV in a year.
That seems right. That's a long time.
Yeah. So, and he did do some stuff in Japan in the meantime and whatnot. I know he did some work in All Japan, but he'd been off TV in the U.S. anyway, so. Yeah, so that was, and then after the match, he didn't unmask until after the match when Heyman introduced him as well as Medusa, who was his CEO, I think is what they were referring to her as. And that was actually the first time in my life I'd heard that term of CEO of anything, and she was of the Dangerous Alliance, so. And then they just started adding to it from there. They added Steve Austin, stunning
well,
Steve
Austin.
Well,
they did that angle on TV, and I don't remember the detail, where Paulie introduced everybody from the back.
Okay, see, I didn't see that.
And I don't remember exactly how it went. I'm pissed off right now because I can't remember. I want to say it was like a grand unveiling, and he may have technically already done little bits and pieces on TV or hints where he had already, like, signed them individually. But then they did the thing where, like, they brought them all out. Like, he introduced each one of them individually. And I think that may have been what he christened them, the Dangerous Alliance official. But it was, it was Rude, Arn, Bobby Eaton, and Steve Austin.
Yeah. And, leading up to the, basically everyone going into that had been, Steve Austin was TV champion at the time. He'd come in with Lady Blossom, who was actually Chris Adams' ex-wife and ended up being Steve Austin's wife. She was his manager until probably just up until about November when the Dangerous Alliance formed. You had that big angle at the Clash of the Champions where Rude defeated Sting for the U.S. title, and that was a really, really solid show, that Clash of the Champions.
Yep, I was there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's right. That's why it was so big.
Well, you gotta understand, this is like, this might even be the high point for me going to wrestling shows, because they ran around Charleston a lot, and I was at a lot of these shows, because I've told this story before, but I had a friend whose dad worked security for a bunch of different venues all over this area, and by this area, I mean Carolina, Savannah, et cetera, I got to go to a lot of shows for free during this period. And
of course, what you mean is that Jake Roberts was your friend and the dad was Grizzly Smith.
Yes. But he, to me, the Dangerous Alliance, and yes, the crowds were sparse. Yes, business was absolutely horrible during this period. Absolute low point of WCW. But
look at that show, man.
But, I mean, but the angle with Sting in the ambulance and Rude, I mean, like, I remember, like, the punches they exchanged on the rampway when Sting got, because Sting had been hurt earlier in the night. They did this angle where Sting got attacked earlier in the night, and he got his leg clipped, then he came back. Like, they did the thing where he was going to get counted out, and
he got
came
his leg
back.
Clipped by Luger.
What's that?
He got his leg clipped by Luger.
Yes, he had his leg clipped by Luger because Medusa was seductively dancing for him.
That'll get you every time.
And, at this point, poor Dave Musgrave thought CEO stood for something totally else, totally different than what it does. And, honestly...
Cleaning Eddie's organ?
Jesus Christ.
I think she was with Eddie Gilbert, wasn't she, at that point?
Yes, at one point. Maybe at this point. I don't know. But she definitely was, for a fact. But she,
that's
like, the way this angle was done was just completely awesome, because Sting was gone, and they did the count out, like, you know, they did the, oh, he's going to be counted out of the building, and they started the count out, and then the ambulance, they showed it backstage, he gets out of the ambulance, and he's got his leg in this a cast-type deal, and he comes hobbling out, and his entrance music hits, and the place goes totally insane, because that was when Sting actually had the awesome, like, basically, like, cheesy 80s guitar riff entrance music. And he gets into the punching match with Rude on the stage, and then they have, like, a five-minute match, and it was, like, the best thing ever. Yeah, that's, like, one of my favorite, literally one of my favorite things ever in the history of wrestling, is that segment.
Well, right. And at that time, too, they had the tag champs were great tag champs, and the enforcers of Arn Anderson and Larry Zbysko.
Yep.
Larry Zbysko having just come from being, you know, a kind of very lackluster world champion in AWA, or, you know, their last world champion. And, you know, some people might say he was okay, but a lot of people wouldn't say that. So.
Yeah. I mean, you guys are crazy. That Larry Zbysko and Nikita match is way better than that piece of shit Manny Wahoo's trap. But we'll ignore that for now.
Yeah.
I just had to get that in.
So the unfortunate thing is that the enforcers were added into the Dangerous Alliance, as was Steve Austin. At all of 1991, after the Midnight Express broke up, and Lane and Cornette left the promotion, Bobby Eaton was billed as, you know, a really good babyface, including a match I really liked in with his TV title win over Arn Anderson at Super Bowl. And then he lost that title to Steve Austin quite quickly, which I found out about when I was watching Great American Bash live. I didn't even know Steve Austin was – or I heard Steve Austin was going there, and then he shows up with the TV title. So – because, again, I didn't have up-to-date TV. So, anyways, from there, Eden ends up teaming with Dustin Rhodes, and I think it was possibly against the Enforcers, actually. and he turns on him, and then he joins the Alliance, and Eaton and Anderson are made the tag team, which, I mean, they were both known as, like, the master tag wrestlers at the time, so it was really kind of, it was a dream tag team to see them together.
Yes.
And it was kind of, you know, maybe they could have made more of it, I guess, but it was still pretty fun to see them together, and they feuded with the Steiners. But yeah, at that Clash of the Champions, I almost said Bash of the Champions, the Enforcers lost the tag belts to Dustin Rhodes and the returning Ricky Steamboat, who then lost it to Eaton and Anderson. So.
Yeah. And this also was setting the stage also because Steamboat would eventually be a major opponent for Rude. Like, see,
yeah.
All this stuff worked together. That, like, I mean, yes, the business was awful, but all this stuff, I mean, like, the genius of the Dangerous Alliance to me was, first of all, everybody in the group worked. I mean, the worst guy in the group was Austin, who at that point I think was, to be honest, a limited wrestler, but he was very capable of being carried. He would always work hard, if nothing else.
You would think he was the worst. He was the worst, and not Zbyszko.
Oh, Zbyszko was vastly superior. I don't even think that's open for debate. I mean, like, to me, like, and by the way, and I mean, this isn't even me like extolling the virtues of Larry per se, as much as it is that Austin, I think was visibly green during that period, and he had. I mean, he was a better athlete. I mean, if from that perspective, you could argue he was better. But as far as a polished, complete wrestler, I mean, I think Larry absolutely destroyed him. In fact, I think Larry was maybe the third best guy in the group, which normally you'd be like, third best guy in the group, but then you look who else is in the group, and you're like, well, yeah, and then, you know, that's actually kind of sad. I think he might have been better than Bobby, because he was very good. At that point, he was still doing his stalling stuff, but it didn't dominate the matches. He was working harder than he'd ever worked before. I think maybe because, you know, again, try to stay relevant, try to survive, changing wrestling landscape. He also, during that period, was a period where I saw him get so much heat that a fan lit a cup on fire and dropped it on his head at the McAllister Fieldhouse in Charleston, which is probably the most insane thing I've ever seen a fan do. So,
yeah, so is this like when someone says that they have a friend who needs counseling, you saw a fan light a cup on fire and throw it on Larry Zbyszko?
No comment. No. But, yeah, so I mean, all of them, but the point is, all five of them could work. I think Austin was a weak link. If you want to disagree with that, that's fine. But the point is, all five of them were good. And really, I would say four of the five were really good. And, you know, Rude, to me, was maybe the best wrestler in the United States in 1992.
Yeah, and that was that was certainly his best work. And, yeah, I would say the best in the U.S. at that point, yeah.
Yeah, and the thing is, I think part of the thing... Like,
him or Brett, probably.
I think Rude was way better than Brett in 92. But this is... That's neither here nor there. That's a totally separate debate. But the point is, Rude... all of this, I mean, people say, oh, yeah, you're talking about the workers, you're not talking about Heyman. But Heyman, to me, or Dangerous, whatever the hell term you want to use, I don't give a shit. I don't want to say it wouldn't have worked with anybody else because that's wrong, but first of all, they have a cool name. The Dangerous Alliance is a cool name. I don't give a shit what anybody says.
Yeah,
having a cool name in wrestling is part of it. That actually is part, it matters to have a cool, something that's marketable, something that has a, it jumps out at you, something that will last and you'll remember. But also the thing about it was you could kind of believe that this shystery guy would be able to con all these guys together and make them into this group. I don't know that any other manager at that time period would have been as fun to watch in that role. I don't want to say it was good because business sucked, but he was extremely fun to watch in that role. Because he seemed like the most obvious guy that would get these five guys together in the team. Like, makes perfect sense. I mean, I love Cornette, but I could never have seen Cornette doing that. I just he would not have been the right guy.
And as far as his actual work goes, like you mentioned Rude and Steamboat. Well, I just remember, I mean, everyone will and should talk about the Iron Man match they had at Beach Blast 92, which was, again, one of my favorite pay-per-views. But
my favorite WWE match ever, actually.
What's that?
That's actually my favorite WCW match ever. But
yeah, it was fantastic. But leading up to that, they also had just a plain old U.S. title match at, I think it was at Super Brawl 92.
It was Super Brawl. It absolutely
yeah.
was.
Yeah. And there was this whole thing that was just so lame, it seemed at
the
time.
Ninja.
Steamboat had his ninja that was guiding him through it and had his back. And then they did the thing in where they showed the ninja got laid out or something, but he still came out to ringside to help out Steamboat. And then towards the end of the match, he pulls out his, you know, the big honking cell phone. Can you imagine using, like, a little Android as a foreign object these days? But he takes out his foreign object and hauls off and hits Steamboat with it, and it turns out it's Heyman. And I thought that was brilliant, because Heyman was banned from ringside, too.
Yeah, I really love that. I thought that was awesome. And Paulie cut some great promos during that stuff, too, because if you look at that group, like, Rude was a good promo. I do not believe he was a great promo. Austin was totally green at that point, and while I wouldn't call him bad on the mic, there's no way you would call him a great promo at that point.
No.
Sabisco was a very solid promo, but I don't think had the right kind of charisma to really stand out. Bobby Eaton really never cut promos ever at any point, except for early in his career. And then you had Arn, who in my opinion is maybe actually the best promo of all time in terms of believability, but Arn was the visceral, like, you know, like, this is serious business, we're going to kill you guy. Heyman was the promoter. That was kind of his gimmick.
Yeah,
and
he was the Gilbert Gottfried.
Exactly. That's a very good analogy, actually. And he really, to me, again, the absolute right guy for that unit. Because he really was able to put them over strong every single time out. And I mean, there's tons of good, they had so many good matches during this period. It's ridiculous. I mean, pretty much any time the Dangerous Alliance had a match on pay-per-view or TV, it was a good match. Literally.
Yeah.
Like, not just to say nothing to the house shows I saw, and I saw several of them. You know,
you refer to them as the best stable of all time, and I think, you know, you can really look at the Shield as being comparable to them, like the just always having the great match on TV and whatnot.
Oh, I think the Shield, I mean, look, I love the Shield. I did a whole podcast with Alan and Justin Shapiro, you know, about them. But to me, it's way too early to go that far, but what I would say
I'm just saying it's fun like that. I'm not saying there is, well, I think they'll be there, but.
If they keep them together long enough, it's possible.
Yeah.
But what I would say is that they're the Shield are they have the same sort of quality control. You know, if it's Shield matches, it's going to be good. Same thing, like you said. Like, they don't have bad matches. The Dangerous Alliance did not have bad matches ever, you know. I mean, ever. And, God, it's just crazy to think about how good that stuff was. I mean, and I, you know, a lot of...
Well, yeah, I mean, the set that I watched that had a lot of it was the Dustin Rhodes set. And lots of stuff back and forth with him and lots of those guys, so...
Yeah, I mean, well, they wrestled basically the whole babyface roster. That was part of the genius, is you had these five guys, and they could really work anybody. You could put them in a six-man. You could put them in any tag team combination.
They were controlling basically every level of the company.
Yes.
The tag title, absolutely. The TV title, the U.S. title. They were on the world title scene.
You know, so just a great team. And, of course, it all built into War Games 92, which is another one of the best matches in WCW history, really. I mean, and a match that I would guess would probably be if you had – and this has been done before, but if you were to do it again, have a poll of, like, best WCW matches ever, I would guess that match would be probably a lock for the top 10. And I would probably say would be a very strong chance of finishing first. I can't remember where it finished in this Mark's Choice ballot, and God forgive me, but I know it was high. It might have been one. I don't remember. But it would be... Outside of Flair Steamboat, I actually think it would be the favorite to finish first.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's that awesome of a match.
And it was, you know, the five members, which was Rude, Eaton, Arn, Austin, and Zabisco against Sting, the Steiners, Pillman, and was Elegante in it?
Dustin Rhodes.
Dustin Rhodes, okay. I should have remembered that, considering he was my favorite wrestler at the time. So.
Yeah.
And that aforementioned Dustin Rhodes said I was mentioning. So, yeah.
Wait a minute. Pillman wasn't in that match. Pillman was in 91.
You're right.
It was Barry Windham, I think.
Barry Windham, yeah. Yeah, you're right. I'm an idiot.
No. I mean, you may be an idiot, but not for that.
Not for that.
You're an idiot because you're talking to me on the phone right now in the middle of the night about Paulie Dangerous. But not
And the other thing that makes me an idiot is that that's taking me away from writing my George Hines bio. George Hines, Jackie Fulton. So.
World's favorite wrestler, I hear.
And the one weakness of the Dangerous Alliance angle is that it really did just kind of peter out. Like, it didn't really have any big finale or anything like that.
Well, I think part of the problem is that they did the whole thing where Larry was the weak link. That was kind of the out, is that Larry was the weak link, and then it kind of spiraled from there. But the problem is...
the creative changeovers.
I think the big problem was that there was just nothing was making money. So it was like, okay, well, this isn't working either. Let's just go to something else. You know, artistically, as a fan, I thought it was awesome at the time, and I still think it's awesome. But
it would have been cool to see a blow-off to it.
Sure, but I think the reason it probably wasn't a concentrated effort to really blow it off in a meaningful, big impact way is because I'm sure the people in charge were just like, well, nobody gives a shit about this, so why should we? You know,
yeah.
I mean, like, that's probably why it petered out the way it did.
What I actually foresaw what I think they were actually working towards at the time was, they were working Zbyszko out of the group. I actually think they were trying to work on a heel turn for Big Josh, Matt Bourne, because he seemed to be doing some heel stuff on TV, but he ended up leaving the company. So I think he was going to be joining the Alliance, actually. That's always one of my
theories. I hope that's true, because it's hilarious if it is.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, I think I think without the Big Josh aspect, I think he could have been really good as a heel there.
Oh, yeah. Matt Bourne's a good wrestler, dude. Real good.
Yeah.
No question.
And,
about it.
He ended up in ECW later, you know, doing work for Heyman there, so.
Yep.
But he ended up going and being Doink, so. Which, again, I really liked in the beginning, too. So.
Oh, heel Doink was great.
So, from there, I mean, Heyman kind of, you know, he was in WCW, I guess, through, that was 92 when that kind of just finished up, and he was there into 93, but that's the year he ended up leaving. Ended up out of there in early 93, around the time that Bill Watts got fired. He managed to get a lawsuit, basically a discrimination lawsuit as well out of that. So, because of all the heat that was on Bill Watts with some of his comments, and, you know, you can defend Bill Watts and as much as you want for, you know, equal opportunities. But yeah, the guy was pretty racist, I think. I don't know if I agree with that, actually,
but that's just like, that's a complicated subject in and of itself. I think Watts was racist in the way that you're not allowed to be racist if you're a guy in any decision-making position. And by that I mean is he was racist in the sense that I don't think he cared about workplace diversity.
I think that's a pretty fair statement.
The other hand, he's, I think, inarguably the least racist wrestling promoter in history when it comes to actually promoting and African Americans in a meaningful way. I don't think there's ever been a less racist promoter than Bill.
Yeah, no,
certainly
not
Vince McMahon.
You cannot take that away from him at all.
Yeah. A complicated figure, that Bill Watts.
Yeah, but just because he was willing to make money with black wrestlers does not mean he was not racist against them.
Oh no, that is perfectly true, and probably, I mean, but see, man, this is a big can of worms. I'm not even sure if I should open it. But I guess what I would say is that is true. But the flip side to that is just because you're willing to have workplace diversity doesn't mean you're not a visceral hate monger either. I think, or even. And maybe a slightly less over-the-top way of putting it would be, just because you're willing to have literally seven or eight guys that gimmick is dancing black guy, modern WWE, doesn't mean that your product isn't racist. So you can look at both sides of that coin. But enough about that.
So he ends up getting fired from WCW. And... basically, I don't know what he did in between WCW and ending up in ECW, other than he ended up involved with the World Wrestling Network. And in July, and that was basically Jim Crockett Jr., you know, had sold WCW to Ted Turner in late 1988. And then Jim Crockett Jr. had a no-compete clause and then decided he was going to start up the World Wrestling Network. And part of their idea in 1993 was that they were going to broadcast in high definition and do internet broadcasts. And I actually do think that is actually directly connected to the current World Wrestling Network with, like, Sal Hamway and Gabe Sapolsky. Like, I think Sal was actually involved in that back at the time, which is how he uses that name now. I could be wrong. That could be totally insane in saying that. But I think I've heard that somewhere. So,
I'll have to take your word on that, but that actually is kind of interesting to me.
Yeah, so he ended up involved with that. They did a show in July of 1993 that had an attendance of like 2,156, and I think they had possibly Jake Roberts versus Bob Orton on that. They certainly, Jake Roberts and Road Warrior Hawk were two of the big guys that they wanted to make use of in that. And then in February 1994, they had a fairly, I guess probably you'd call it a big show by indie standards, at the Manhattan Center. And it was a TV taping, and they had basically a lot of ECW guys on it. So you had Jake, Bob Orton, the Convict, who I assume was Nails, with manager Sherry Martel, 911, Bruise Brothers, Jason Knight, Public Enemy, Bad Company, Tommy Dreamer, Terry Funk, JT Smith, Road Warrior Hawk, Mikey Watson. And I don't know if that's Whipwreck or not. It might be, though. But that's February 1994. So, Taz was there. Who else was kicking around there? Yeah, Sabu as well. So, basically, a lot of the stuff he ended up doing with ECW was kind of, I think, what was planned for that group, but it just didn't end up going anywhere, partially because of, I don't think Jim Crockett Jr. liked what he did with the NWA angle, so. But, to backtrack, summer of 1993, Heyman ends up going into ECW, which was being booked at the time by Eddie Gilbert, his old buddy, and, I think, we would know from having watched Barbed Wire City that it really looks like it's always kind of been the reputation that Heyman squeezed out Gilbert and kind of took his spot. But, I think the impression was that Gilbert was probably on his way out regardless. And Heyman kind of ended up in his spot, which, if prior history with Gilbert is any indication, was quite possibly true.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought that was one of the more interesting things in Barbed Wire City, because it's sort of, the narrative, you're right, is that Heyman double-crossed his best bud and then took his job. But I think what may have been more likely is that Gilbert was already being Gilbert, as he often was, and maybe he expected Paul to leave with him if he was going to leave, or to, you know, not take his job if he decided to leave his job. But I don't think there's any question. I think the story of Heyman squeezing him out is, if anything, probably an exaggerated story that people want to believe because it inflates the legacy of Paul Heyman, the carny, even more, you know. But, yeah, I don't think I mean, people have to remember, like, ECW in its early days was a much different promotion. You had a lot of older veterans, including a lot of the guys you just mentioned.
But, yeah,
the
early title lineage is, like, Terry Funk is in there, but you also have Jimmy Snuka, Tito Santana, Don Morocco. So
yep.
that's a very different kind of promotion than it was once Mr. Heyman got involved. But by the time Heyman did get involved, his first match show that he was promoter of was ECW Ultra Clash 93, which was September 1993. I've never watched all of that show, but I've always been kind of fascinated by it, for sure.
Well, that's the show, I think, that really sort of is the first show. It's the first show that feels like an ECW show. Because
yes.
it's the show that has the crazy brawl with the Headhunters and Crash the Terminator and Miguel Perez Jr. with a baseball bat and brawl all over the arena, which is like the first match you really think of as, wow, this is batshit crazy. I mean, they did stuff before then that was crazy brawls, but the difference is that featured a bunch of guys that weren't really known at the time.
Mm-hmm.
They were just basically told to go out there and just literally tear the arena apart. And then, you know, in a crazy gimmick match, I mean, it was a different feel to that. And I think, you know, that match, in hindsight, in the broad scope of things, it really doesn't mean much. But it's the first match that I really think of as an ECW match, if that makes sense. The very first one. So
yeah, and even on that show, you know, you had a Public Enemy was starting to, you know, be a part of the show at that point. Terry Funk and Stan Hansen against Kevin Sullivan and Abdullah the Butcher, kind of transitioning from having the veterans in there but to having, like, the hardcore style.
Yeah.
And, you know, Shane Douglas was the ECW champ at the time, and he wrestled the Sandman, you know. So you're really getting some of those.
I think Sandman was still in a surfer gimmick, though, at that point.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. And that was, I don't know if it was the first show at the ECW arena, but it was around there.
Near that time. I actually think there were shows before then at the arena, but that was near the very beginning, if not the first one.
Yeah. And then after that, you know, you also had NWA Bloodfest, which was the first weekend in October 1993. And things really went to another level there, too, right? Terry Funk and Jimmy Snuka had a big cage match that I have actually seen, and it was pretty fun.
Yeah, fun match.
Yeah, and I think Sabu and the Tasmaniac had a match on that show. And I think that was the debut for both of them. I know it was, at least for Sabu.
Well, yeah. You got to remember, too, like,
Sabu was a huge name on the indies at that point.
Yeah, 93, 94, there was nothing like him. I mean, I've said this before on the show and on other shows. Sabu was... I've said before that Rey Mysterio really was the last, and I think that's technically true. But Rey came along at a time when the game had already changed a little bit, which so it was slightly different. Sabu was that last wrestler that you learned about through PWI or through whatever, and then you couldn't wait to see. And it was like you had to go out of your way to discover this guy. You either had to buy a tape and wait 6 to 8 weeks for it to get to you, or you had to stumble upon a syndicated, you know, television show at 3 a.m. You know, like, and then you saw him, and you were like, yep, this guy is every bit as insane as he's been advertised.
Yeah.
And, you know, to me, like, this isn't a knock on Shane Douglas, who I think was really important at the beginning of ECW, too. But to me, the three most important guys in ECW becoming a big deal and becoming a national promotion first a big indie promotion and then eventually a national promotion. But the three guys that really set the table to me were Terry Funk, because he was a legend that gave him credibility, Sabu, because he was the totally new identity and face that was just, unbelievable that it caught, if you came for Terry Funk, you stayed for Sabu. And then, of course, Heyman for having the vision to put it together.
Yeah, Heyman really had his finger on the pulse at that point. Like, I don't know if anyone has as much since that point or going up to that point that I've seen in terms of he was doing stuff that nobody was doing. But, you know, he was basically operating as, you know, doing fantasy booking for what he wanted and that he thought other people would want too. And it was just awesome.
Well, yeah, I mean, like, and I think with ECW, it's pointless to try and follow a point-by-point timeline. Not that I'm saying you shouldn't insert relevant things that we missed, but, like, it's hard to, I think, because there are various things that you can point to as big changes. And first of all, if anybody wants to, you know, do that, they can just watch Barbed Wire City, and because even though it's not a timeline, it's going to give you kind of an outline of when this happened and that happened and relevant changes. But or you can watch Rise and Fall for that matter too, if you wanted a more explicit timeline.
But
sorry,
especially
John.
Go out and buy Barbed Wire City.
I think like you got the early Avon 93, then of course you have the NWA title tournament in 94 where, you know, they have the tournament and Shane Douglas wrestles Chico Scorpio in the finals. Shane Douglas takes the belt, throws it to the ground, says it's a dead title, he doesn't want to represent that, and then lists these two. Everybody, I think, sort of knows that. I don't really think that's really a big mystery.
That was gutsy to do that.
You know what's funny? I actually don't think it was gutsy. And because the NWA was a dead promotion, there was never going to be any consequence for it. There was no real possible repercussion that was going to come from it. What I will say is, while I don't think it was gutsy, nobody was going to do it anyway. They're still the only people that would have done it. So even though I don't actually think it was a gutsy move,
I think it was.
Well, I mean, I can't use the term gutsy because what were the repercussions going to be?
I'm just screwing around, man.
you know what I mean? Like there was no possible repercussions that could come
and
from that.
It might very much seem like, you know, when you look back to the history of things that, you know, ECW is being granted this big thing by having the prestige of the NWA title, but you know, the NWA in a large way was kind of riding on them as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
They were getting a lot
out
of it, you know.
To me, what was amazing about it wasn't that it was gutsy. Although, I mean, I understand why you would use that term. But to me, what was amazing about it is nobody else would do it because there were these rules in wrestling, these protocols, these things you didn't do. You had to, you know, these things that you're supposed to respect certain things. And, you know, and maybe in the long haul, that stuff's for the best, to be honest. But at that time, with wrestling as shitty as it was, because, look, I love 94 WCW, a lot of the stuff, but a lot of it was really hokey. That was also around the time Hogan was coming in and the whole company would go to complete trash. WWF was really, frankly, not very good during that period. I mean, it was just not very good. Very boring, very bland, very cartoony. I mean, you had Bret, you had Shawn, you had Owen, you had some guys that were working hard, but it was not an adult program at all. And it certainly didn't have anything.
I think what we can say about the two main promotions is that ultimately they were just out of touch.
They were out of touch. They certainly didn't have anything and anything can happen feel. I mean, not at all. But quite to the contrary, if anything. What made this event so incredible was that it was just like, you know what? We're not going to pretend that all this wrestling tradition, you know, stuff it means dick all when you're trying to build a new company. Because guess what? It really doesn't. That's what was so amazing about it, is that there was no pretense of playing by these carny rules. In a way, it was actually sort of an anti-carny move, because there was no, like, we're not going to abide by these bizarre wrestling traditions where you're supposed to do X, Y, and Z. And you're like, no, we're just not going to do it because we're trying to build a new promotion. And it was a double cross.
Yeah.
And it was
a take-no-prisoners approach, too.
Yeah. And I mean, a lot of people, even to this day, even people who ended up liking ECW think that was a scumbag thing to do. I actually think it was great. I'm glad they did it. And not even because it kickstarted ECW, but because – I wish more stuff like that happened in wrestling, not just because of the surprise factor, but because at the end of the day, if you're trying to build a new promotion or trying to build something relevant, you can't rely on carcasses of old stuff. You have to do different things. You have to try and do interesting things. I don't know. I love it. I thought it was awesome. I still think it's awesome. I don't have any problem with it. I don't think it was a scumbag move any more than any myriad of other things. You know, like people talk about that being a scumbag move. A scumbag move is like, you know, not paying anybody for months, which we'll get to. That's not like, this is not, doesn't even compare to that. But, you know, and then from there, that was really, you know, I guess the touchstone, because that's when the Extreme name came around and then the branding really started. And then the branding is really where I think Paul was so great. I mean, I understand the argument. Well, ECW was never made money. Okay. And I understand the argument.
But...
you know. Well, I mean, that's the same argument. I mean, like, one of the things, like, when Heyman came up for the Observer Hall of Fame, for example, was how can you put a guy in as a promoter who never was a successful promoter in the way that every single other person that's in the Hall of Fame is. You know, how can you do that? And, I mean, people could say, oh, well, managing. I don't really think managing was the reason he got in. I think he got in because he was the guy who was the mad mastermind behind ECW. I think at the end of the day, that's why he's in there. And I understand that argument. And I don't even want to get into whether or not he deserves to be in the Observer Hall of Fame. But my point is...
I think just overall, I mean, there's so many things he did that other promoters didn't.
I think it's one of these things where it's very easy to overrate and underrate ECW. It's very easy to do both. I think it's very easy to say ECW is the sole catalyst to change the... I mean, there are people who argue this, that if it wasn't for ECW, I've literally heard people argue, including people who aren't stupid, that if it wasn't for ECW, WWF would have gone out of business. I don't believe that. You know, I don't think that's true at all. I've heard people say that...
I think it would have been very different, though.
It very well might have. You know, I think there is a lot to the argument that Heyman influenced wrestling in massive ways. I think it... The question is... How much did he influence wrestling... And how much do we imagine or believe he influenced wrestling based on our own memories as hardcore fans? And I don't have an answer for that. I honestly don't know the answer to that question. I don't think anybody does.
Well, and something you've heard me say many times, too, though, is, you know, something like, say, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Is it based just on record sales or is it based on, you know, cultural contributions and just overall quality as well?
Oh, sure. But, I mean, I like it. I was trying to avoid this debate, but you're going to draw me into it. Paul Heyman is in the Observer Hall of Fame. Don Owen isn't. What's the difference? Well, the difference is Don Owen actually made money for a long time. That's not a knock on Paul Heyman. I mean, and people say, well, Paul Heyman was more influential than Don Owen, and maybe that's true. I mean, it probably is true.
I think he was, yeah.
Well,
the thing is, we can't forget what comes after ECW, too, right?
Yeah, I actually think ECW was influential in ways that people forget. See, like, the way people always point to is, well, the Attitude Era, okay? And I think that, obviously, Paul, and I guess we should mention kind of a little bit of this stuff. Like, obviously the music videos, which were a big deal that he really capitalized on, with modern music that was kind of relevant. The big theatrical entrances for guys like the Gangsters or Public Enemy or the Sandman. Obviously the ultraviolence, which I actually think kind of is inflated, although there's no question that it was a big part of the product, particularly with the limited guys who, frankly, maybe not would have gotten a chance anywhere else if they weren't doing that sort of stuff.
I think you could argue too, though, that he had possibly just as much of an influence on today's product with the pushing of work rate type wrestlers.
Well, see, it's funny you should say that, because that's actually kind of where I was going. And I don't, this is actually kind of the thing where I think his influence is underrated, but I also think I don't know whether it's actual influence to the degree we think it is, or if it's hardcore fans want to see the influence, so we see it. Because when you look at, I mean, it's not just Eddie and Benoit and Dean Malenko and those guys who he used. I mean, I do think if he hadn't used them, WCW would probably have not signed them. I think that's very unlikely that they would have ever been signed. WCW had a working agreement with New Japan. Well, so
I think they would have signed. I think they would have signed Benoit, but
they might have. But I don't know that. You know, like I.
Well, they did
I mean,
beforehand. So.
Well, they had 93, but they did nothing with them. You know, like
yeah.
I'm very skeptical about the argument that WCW would have signed them anyway, just because they had a working agreement with New Japan. Well, okay, so what? Like,
I don't think they would have with the other two. No.
If they weren't going to do well, my thinking is like it's not like we know for a fact they were going to do a cruiserweight division and give it a hard push. You know, were they going to? I mean, maybe they would have, but we don't know that. Like. I think it's very hard to say. I mean, the one argument is that Eric Bischoff would throw money at anybody, so that's a good argument. The flip side is Eric Bischoff mainly threw money at guys to basically take them away from other people. So if they weren't with somebody else, was he really going to sign them? You know. But I actually think the bigger point with Heyman and work rate guys and stuff like that is ECW toward the end with guys like Tajiri and Super Crazy and Lil Guido. You know, every night having really good matches, and I've watched them all. What those guys were doing is sort of, when ECW went out of business, that's what kind of, that style and those guys even, is kind of what evolved into the early Ring of Honor, Northeast Indies sort of style. I mean, that's kind of where it came from.
Absolutely it was, yeah. And the other branched out into CZW and IWA itself.
And Jersey All-Pro, too, which I think is worth mentioning if you're going to mention these groups. You know, but so to me, in a way, that is actually a bigger influence in my mind in some ways than the Attitude Era stuff. But having said that, I always, in the back of my head, because influence is such a vague thing, it's so hard to really, like, I'm such a skeptic when it comes to that a part of me is always like, okay, yes, we see that, but do we see that because we're hardcore fans and we want to see it, or do we see that because it's actually the case? And I think that's the question mark with a lot of this stuff. Having said that, I think one thing that, you know, Heyman was genius was. Heyman, maybe his single biggest contribution in terms of influence, actually, is brand loyalty and brand identity being more important than anybody on the roster.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's the name of the game in wrestling now. And it doesn't matter where you are. I mean, we joked about Chikara earlier, but obviously I think Chikara is the heir to the cult-like, slavishly devoted fans who will argue that everything that the company does is right and just, no matter what. But I think WWE obviously brands the exact same way ECW did, in the sense that the WWE is the name on the marquee. You know, it's the brand, it's the identity. Every star is interchangeable, sans, you know, Cena, basically. And ECW was the same way. You know, it was the fans were chanting ECW. They didn't, you know, and that to me. And people could say, well, Vince would have done this anyway when there was no more competition left. And he probably would have, but Paul was the first guy to do that. The first guy to exalt the brand above everything else, which in a way is actually a negative influence, by the way. But I think it was something he had to do because the talent he had was didn't have as much name value, obviously. And it was harder to build around because you couldn't pay him as much, and they might leave any day.
Well, but it's also, I don't think it's just because the guys he had would leave. I think he also probably saw it as something that was valuable in and of itself, not just as a way to avoid the problem of, you know, guys getting signed up, but just as something, you know, he really identified the value of branding, which is, you know, being in touch with pop culture.
Yes. No, I think it's both. I think you're right. Yeah, I think it's both. I don't think it's one or the other. I think he had to do it and he wanted to do it, if that makes sense. Like, I think he had to do it for practical reasons. And
those
clearly
two things
did.
Fed off each other with a real synergy, you know.
Exactly. Like, you know, but the same urgency that made it a necessity, I think, was also a benefit. And I think at the same time, he wanted to do it. And, you know, I mean, as far as business goes, like, ECW, from a business perspective, is such a crazy company, because you mentioned this on the last show we did with Johnny, which is a great show, and if people haven't heard it, the show we did with the second show we did with John Philip Savage was awesome. The first show was great too, but I really liked the second show a lot.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we'd seen the show, and Johnny's just—I can't say enough about what a
great guest, great guy, and a very strong supporter of this podcast, by the way. So, you know, I. One of my favorite people to talk wrestling with, or really anything with. But when we did that show, like, you made a comment that I can't remember exactly what you said, but basically the gist of it was you can really have a half full, half empty look at ECW as a business phenomenon, because on the one hand you could say, well, this really isn't that impressive. It's a
yeah,
company.
Well,
that,
yeah, basically the way I look at it is you can say, why did it, you know, it's a failure. Paul Heyman was a failure because it ultimately went out of business. Like, how didn't it go further? Whereas the other aspect is, how did it even possibly get as far as it did?
Yes, that's basically how you put it. And I thought that was actually maybe the most genius thing that's ever been said about Paul Heyman and ECW, because part of the reason ECW, even to this day, remains so polarizing as a conversation piece among people who are interested about things like the business history of promotions and things like that is, I don't think there's a really good way to talk about it, because it's completely uncomparable to anything else. I mean,
yeah.
It wasn't an existing territory. It was a territory that was created and then was no longer a territory. It became a national promotion through syndication after syndication was practically irrelevant. I mean, like, just that alone makes it a totally unique and bizarre thing. And, you know, you look at all these, like, their first pay-per-view, and a lot of people have criticized this, being at the ECW arena. To me, it had to be at the ECW arena.
Yeah, I'm
you know,
disappointed,
like,
they all were in some way. They're all were
yes,
in some way.
Like, you know, like, that, it had to be there. Like, that just, it would have been stupid not to, you know, like, because that was such an integral part of the brand and the identity and everything. And just, I look at it, I'm like, okay, I get the argument that they never made money. I get the argument that they weren't running big buildings. I get the argument that they didn't get huge ratings when they were on TV, although the ratings were not terrible by any stretch on TNN, and that was with a show that really was never promoted at all. But
and was in a bad time slot.
Yeah, it was all terrible. From Friday night, Jesus, awful time. Basically the worst possible time slot you could have if you were trying to sell your promotion as hip and cool to college-age alcoholics and drug addicts. I mean, you couldn't possibly have a worse time slot. But on the flip side of that coin, it's like they were, you know, with a hugely great talent pool in a lot of ways, they were drawing a couple thousand people all over the place at
yeah.
a time when the other two companies had a shitload more money than them, a ton more resources, a ton more history, a ton more name talent. I mean, it really is.
There was really no reason for them to be doing as well as they were.
No, not at all. You know, and people say, oh, well, it failed. It did fail. It failed because there was nobody who could have made it work. There just wasn't. I mean, the time period was terrible. People can say Heyman was a bad business guy, and he probably was. But there was nobody who was going to make that work. No one. Because the dynamics just weren't there. I mean, now looking back, when ECW went out of business, largely, at least in part, in theory, because they couldn't get TV, there's tons more stations now. They would have had a much better shot of getting on TV now than they did then.
Yeah, I have fun fantasy booking what 2001 would have been like, too, if they had made it. But.
I think you would have seen... I mean, Heyman has said, he actually recently said this in a WWE.com article. I don't know if you saw this, Dave. It's a very interesting article. And I got the impression that the article was done partially because of Barbed Wire City, even though that's just my opinion. But it was like basically like, you know, they interviewed Steve Corino and Heyman and several other people and asked them where they asked them what ECW, what would have happened to ECW if it had stayed open. And, you know, apparently Corino was going to reform the Impact Players with him and Lance Storm slot, you know, whatever. That was kind of teased, actually. I remember that. Heyman was going to push CW Anderson. That was a guy that was going to get a big push, which I think was pretty obvious based on the last pay-per-view, too.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure he was going to win the TV title tournament.
Yeah. I mean, like, Kid Cash was going to get a big push.
And,
Easy Money.
And
was
should
get
have,
a big
too, right?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I'm a huge CW Anderson mark to this day, but Easy Money was going to get a big push. But Heyman was adamant that he was going to, that the hardcore stuff was basically over. Like, now, I don't know if I totally agree with that, but I do think it probably was to the point where it was going to be scaled back, because I think he, at that point, had realized, look, we're not going to be able to get on TV and stay on TV if we're doing this stuff. It's going to be too hard. And he had all these guys that were basically guys like Kid Cash, Easy Money, people like that, that were basically doing that Northeast Indie ROH style. So I think you would have probably seen stuff like that in ECW first. I mean, whether or not that would have been the prevailing theme, I think is questionable. But I think it would have been a big part of ECW going forward. And another thing that came out in that interview, and this is very much debatable, but Heyman, there's a lot of business stuff that was interesting that came out. But Heyman claims that Vince McMahon actually went to the USA Network and went to bat for Paul and argued for them to take the ECW show. Yeah, which I think is fascinating, because I think it shows, if that's true, and maybe that's bullshit, but that wouldn't shock me if it was true, because I think it shows two things. I think one, it shows that Vince was already concerned at that point about where he was going to get new talent.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it also shows that Vince and Paul have always had this weird respect relationship, love-hate relationship, where I think they both really respect each other, even though I don't know that they actually like each other. And it really... You know, you see it pop up at various points with Paul being able to use this talent, Paul getting loans from Vince, you know, Paul continually being put in positions of somewhat relevance and power in WWE, even though there's no question he was pissing people off the whole time.
And could have been in a longer position of power. Like, he had the chance in 2006 into 2007 to be in charge of developmental. He just didn't feel that was what he wanted to do with his life at that point.
Yeah, I think Vince really respects Paul. And I think, actually, to be honest, I suspect that Vince looks at Paul and sees a lot of himself. And I think the big difference between Vince McMahon and Paul Heyman is that Vince McMahon's rich daddy already owned a wrestling promotion and Paul Heyman's didn't.
Yeah,
that's really the big difference. I don't think there's a whole lot of difference beyond that.
No. And, you know, I honestly see Heyman. Okay, so, I mean, ECW closes in 2001. I also think it's pretty obvious that Johnny Swinger and Simon Diamond were going to win the tag titles.
Yep, I agree with that.
Yeah, and I think that would have been great. I think that was one of the really cool angles they had at the end that didn't get a chance to go where it could have. But from there, you know, he ends up in WWE and he ends up being, you know, head booker at different times. But, you know, I mean, no one can debate that SmackDown in 2002 was just really great with him on charge.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, how many other eras in modern WWE have a name that we use for them?
Yeah, exactly. That wasn't even the main. That wasn't even the main event stuff.
No, no.
And he was directly involved on TV in the main event stuff, and that was great too. With I thought Brock against Undertaker was great, and then Brock. I really liked the Big Show's turnaround then as
I
well.
I did too. Well, I liked all that stuff. I really liked all that stuff in general. I thought that was. I mean, 2002 SmackDown is not my favorite. Period of wrestling necessarily, but it was very good. And again, it was really fresh because you had these guys that were basically told, hey, go have good matches. Now, how hard is that really? Go get it.
Yeah.
Like, basically what happened is there was a bunch of guys that could work, and the promoter said, hey, you know how you guys are going to get over? By having good matches.
Yeah.
And
even little things, too, like bringing in Brian Kendrick as Spanky.
Yes, yeah.
Like, even his introduction to him I thought was fun. So, well, actually,
I
shouldn't say even. I should say especially.
Yeah, like to me, like that, like that's a perfect example. Like, you often hear about how Heyman, in some ways, was the precursor to Russo-style booking, which I actually think is true, by the way. Even though I like the vast majority of Heyman's stuff as a booker, I think that's a very fair point.
He was just the good version of it.
Yes. The crash style in ECW, where one angle would happen in the ring, then the very next angle would happen, the very next. That was the most famous, probably the night with when Lawler came in. There were like five angles that happened in a row in 20 minutes. And,
June
but it was 97, awesome.
I think it was? Yeah.
Yeah, it was 97. It was awesome. But, it was a lot. And it was very similar in tone to how Russo would do stuff, although drastically different as a big picture. But the big difference is, like, I think Heyman, like, sometimes we point out how revolutionary he was, and he was in a lot of ways. But he was.
He had a lot of aspects where he was a traditionalist too, though.
Yes, that's what I exactly. Thank you. Like he was, and there were times where he was the exact opposite, where it was just simplicity. Like it was maybe it was simplicity with a spin, but it was just simplicity. I think the SmackDown 6 is the perfect example of simplicity. Okay, these guys can all work. We know they're all good workers. We know they're good, they're good talents. We know they can work a fast-paced, work-ready style. So why the hell would we do anything other than just have them go out there and go have good matches? I mean, that's not to say you didn't want to have some angles and reason for them to wrestle. But basically the idea was, these guys are good. Let them prove it.
Well, I think what it compares to, is I think of like when Seinfeld was ending and Jerry Seinfeld said, it's really weird that people talk about us like we're the greatest thing ever, because really it was just this simple, well-done thing. Unfortunately, that's so uncommon.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think with 2002 SmackDown, that's a perfectly the case, because it's not like nobody remembers really the storylines from the SmackDown 6 from those guys. Nobody ever says, boy, remember this great angle they did with Ray in 2002?
Yeah.
It's just,
yeah.
They went out, and by the way, it's Ray was for the most part presented very well the whole time during that period. But I think it's an open question whether or not Ray would have been I think he would have gotten over no matter what, but I think WWE
is
almost
a no-brainer.
I think they're so stupid if left to their own devices that they somehow would have fucked it up.
Yeah,
like I don't think he would have turned into a guy that was a legitimate draw and a guy who draws in a lot of kids and all this stuff, if not for the fact that Heyman was smart enough to just say, hey, you're a good worker, do good worker stuff.
Yeah, and like even the introduction of Cena, I thought that was really good.
Oh yeah, I agree with that. I like all that stuff.
Unfortunately,
Brock,
you just ended
like him
up
as Brock's manager.
What's that?
And I liked him as Brock's manager,
yeah.
and mouthpiece a lot.
And just unfortunately, he just ended up being out of power a few times. He did end up being back you know, he ended up being, actually, I really liked him as an on-air GM. I really liked that. And then, I think he did end up with the book on TV again. I think maybe in 2000. I think it was in 2003. And I don't know if you remember this. It's kind of very forgotten where he was managing Lesnar again. And you know, he had him. He had the Survivor Series team with Lesnar and Matt Morgan and Big Show and Nathan Jones and A-Train. And you know, like just talk about monster heels. Like that was incredible visuals on TV, those guys.
Yeah. I think I just realized we totally passed over the invasion.
Oh yeah, that.
And
so did they. Yeah.
Well, that's true. But what that's actually kind of my point. Like, first of all, can you imagine how pissed off you would be if you were one of those guys in ECW and there's Heyman and he comes out and just shows up as an announcer? But setting that aside, you hadn't been paid in 3 months. There's your boss.
But I also think the flip side of that is how long he hung in there trying to make it work for himself and for the guy.
Oh, I think I honestly believe. I mean, it's really.
If he had it his way, it would have worked.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, I don't think it's like he was like, I'm going to milk this until the very end, and then that's going to be it, and then screw whoever's left behind. I don't believe that at all. I think it was a situation where he honestly thought until the day it was over that he was going to win, that he was going to be able to figure it out, and then he wasn't. And then because he is a carny, and because he's a guy who, you know, survive and move on, that's kind of how he learned in the business, that's what he did.
Well,
I think
people forget that even after Guilty's charge, they had another pay-per-view scheduled and they canceled it.
Yep. People do forget that. I mean, I think the ending of ECW is really fascinating because you had some people in the same WWE.com article. They interviewed Joey Mercury, and he tells a story about how Sandman came to him the night of the last show and said, "That's it. You know, we're done. And don't listen to what anybody else says. This is definitely the end of it." And, you know, Joey didn't want to believe it, you know. And I think a lot of the younger guys, Rhino, guys like Joey Mercury, people like that, they probably were the ones who didn't want to believe it the most. Because this is, you know, they're just now getting a real chance to shine in this promotion, and then it's going to shit the bed. I mean, but I think the older guys, I think, probably sort of knew. I mean, the last Queen show where they brought the Dudleys and Taz back, which a lot of people don't even know they did that, but they did do that. For those who don't know, the last Queen show, they actually brought the Dudleys back in. The Dudleys wrestled in a six-man, if I'm not mistaken.
Was this after Taz had been champion again?
This was after Taz had been champ again, yes.
Yeah, I kind of remember that.
This was the very last show in Queens. They brought these two. They brought the two of them back. And anybody who's seen that show in full, and I've seen the whole show, it's pretty obvious that the assumption at that point is that the company's going out of business. And I don't remember when that was. I would have to look. I want to say it was November of 2000, but it might have been December of 2000. But the point is, by that point, it was pretty like the tone at that point was pretty obvious that it was going to go out of business. So I think it's fascinating that there were people who thought after that point that it was, you know, there was a good chance it was going to survive. But having said that, I think Heyman was still trying even after that point. You know, I think that was probably around the time where it became obvious that unless a miracle happened, they were going to go under. But I think Heyman probably believed that miracle was going to happen right up until it didn't. You know, and that's when he jumped ship. But on the invasion thing, the main thing I wanted to mention is he was the one guy who had something really memorable from the invasion. You know, the big promo with Vince. Like, he was the one guy who had something that I really remember as really being a big deal, even now, you know, 12 years later. Nobody else did anything in there that I remember at all 12 years later. It's only... Yeah. Only Heyman is the only fucking one. And, you know, so even in that point, this epic angle that the company fucked up, he stood out as a guy who had real fire and was actually interesting in a situation that turned into a friggin' disaster.
Yeah.
So, and then of course there's the ECW relaunch. You know, the One Night Stand 2005 was just, I thought it was a major success.
It felt like a real ECW show. There's no question about it.
Yeah.
And, 100% felt like a real ECW show.
What's that?
It 100% felt like a real ECW show. And I think it's almost shocking that they were able to do that, because that is so un-WWE to actually successfully pull that shit off. It's shocking that they were able to do that well. I remember, like, during the Sandman's entrance, he's up in the crowd, and somebody, some fan next to him gets a hold of the cane and starts smashing himself in the head with it. And I remember thinking, yep, this is the real thing.
Yeah, and I mean, that was the first time you saw that sign, you know, which you've seen versions of, you know, if Cena wins, we riot.
No, that was 2006. That was One Night Stand 2006.
Oh, that was, okay, that was the next year, yeah.
Which actually was a better wrestling card. That was
absolutely.
a very good wrestling card. And still kind of felt ECW-ish, but it wasn't, I mean, that was a show that felt ECW-ish. You had a lot of stuff that really felt like ECW. But I think by the end of that show, oddly enough, when Edge was the guy that caused the title change, that's when you knew this ECW relaunch ain't going to work. You know,
yeah,
like.
I got a really good feeling when the zombie came out.
Well, of course. Yeah. I mean, like. And a lot has been said about
it. Ann doesn't even know what I'm talking about, and she even snickered at that.
A lot has been said about that. And a lot of has been theorized about that. And I know people. I'm not far from an insider, but I have friends who know friends and things like that. And I know Heyman wasn't pleased in that first show. Heyman was basically fighting from the very beginning. It's like they gave him this, like, okay, we're going to give you this show and this brand. And then almost immediately it became obvious that they were not going to let him do anything that he really wanted to do. So then it became a fight, I think, to see, okay, they're not really going to let me do what I want to do big picture. What little picture things can I do that are going to have a long-term impact? And ultimately, the little picture thing he did was basically be the guy, supposedly, if you believe this, and I think it's probably true, but he was the guy that pushed for CM Punk politically when nobody else did.
Yeah.
So that was really, and his idea, you know, for the December to Dismember, which is, most people say, the worst WWE pay-per-view ever. I actually don't know that it was, but it was certainly really bad at a time when they were more often than not having good shows.
And, you know, if you went back and watched it, I'm sure there might actually be some half-decent stuff on it, but come on.
I mean, I remember the Hardys Eminem match, which I think is on that show, was actually pretty good. But the thing is, like, it was so un-ECW-y.
That Queen show, by the way, was December 15th, 2000.
Okay, thank you. Okay. So slightly less than a month before the company went out of business. But I think at that point, Heyman already knew, like, it's funny because we hear the story about how supposedly the way he was going to book Elimination Chamber, if I'm not mistaken, was like Punk was going to come in and immediately tap out Big Show and then, like, run through guys and then lose, I guess, to Lashley at the end. I think that's how it was set up, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
How his idea was.
Sure.
And a part of me, like, I mean, I believe that story. In fact, I know that story's true. But a part of me thinks, like, on the one hand, it's like, oh, he really wanted to put over Punk. I kind of think that was his way of knowing, of getting out of it. Because the next show, the very next night, they were in Charleston.
It's the line in the sand at the very least, you know.
The very next night they were in Charleston for Raw, and that was Paul's last night with the company. In fact, I think he left that day, maybe even before the show aired. And I always thought that, yes, he wanted Punk to go over. Yes, that was the guy that he had a vision for. But I always kind of thought he knew that that wasn't going to work. Nobody was going to go for that. And he was going to be able to pitch that idea. And when the show was a disaster because he refused to fight them anymore, he was just going to go, eh, I told you so, fuck this. Like, I actually think that was kind of an out for him more than it was a plan that he really believed in. Not to say he didn't believe in it, but I think he knew there was no way they were going to go for that.
They wouldn't let him.
Yeah, like, I think he partially proposed it because he believed in it and partially proposed it because he knew it would be a way for him to get the hell out of a job he didn't want. You know.
And it's a line of sand. This is what needs to happen. This is my ultimatum, right?
Yeah. That's kind of.
That's what he tells me.
Yeah. but that's just my suspicion. I don't know that for a fact. What I do know for a fact is that he then went to. Okay. Let me ask you this: how much of the OVW Heyman stuff have you seen?
That was previous to this ECW.
That was previous to the relaunch. That was kind of how he got the relaunch.
I've seen some of it. I watched a couple months of it. Like, the production stuff kind of drove me a little crazy. Like, but just some of the booking was really fun.
See, I've heard that the booking under him was awesome, but I've not seen hardly any of it.
Oh yeah, no. Like when you look back at it, like Matt Capitelli and Johnny Jeter had some really good stuff. From there, you also had. Punk and Albright, like a guy, Cornette had a lot of great stuff in OVW, but, you know, again, that's the other side of the same coin where they brought in Heyman and he did a lot of great stuff too, so.
Yeah. I just think, to me, that's an unexplored part of Heyman's legacy. I hope one day somebody would collect that and it would be easier for people to get their hands on that footage. Because I'd be interested to see it now and see how it looks like now, especially knowing that that was the bridge that got him back into getting, you know, the ECW relaunch and then that ending the way it did.
Yeah, and a lot of people were saying, and it was in between the two ECW pay-per-views. The two good ones, I should say. and basically, I mean, I know a lot of people were saying it was the best wrestling in North America at the time.
You know,
television, at least, you know.
Yeah, that was a common refrain, including, in fact, that was said by a lot of people who didn't even like Paul E. So I'd be interested to go back. Maybe that'll be a project I take on one day. Who knows? I tend to take them on. So.
Yeah, me too. Well, in fact, we're in the process of doing one together, but we'll get back to that.
Yes.
And from there, you know, he ends up out of so that leads back to him getting back on TV, which I think is where he should have been. And then he ends up, you know, eventually ends up out of WWE and kind of semi-retired for a few years, but doing a lot of marketing stuff. And, you know, I know, like, at one point I was like, well, whoever hears about his marketing stuff? But honestly, like, whoever hears about any marketing stuff? And apparently he did have some success with, like, viral marketing and stuff, so...
I'll tell you this, Heyman Hustle is a name that a lot of people I know that knew very little about wrestling knew.
Yeah.
So, for whatever that's worth, he was an entity that had something of a following outside of the wrestling bubble. I don't know. You know, he's a survivor, man. He's like the ultimate survivor. He just finds a way.
Yeah.
Like,
and then he ends up back in WWE and...
Well, I mean, he had this association with Brock the whole time, right? I mean, that's really fascinating, too, is the fact that here's a guy who was Brock's on-air manager, who I guess ended up being his actual manager.
I don't know
the details of that or how it works out, but to me, that's totally crazy also. Like, how the fuck did that happen?
I think Brock really respected him, and it's like, where he goes, I go. And if you don't want him, fuck you.
that may be it. Totally incredible, but and now, like you said, now he's been back. How long has he been back now? Let's see, is it?
It's basically probably about 13-14
months.
Yeah. And I know I've heard Alan talk, like, saying that, you know, he hears that Heyman has said that he thinks he now feels like his character has legs, that he can be on TV for another 15 years, so...
Jesus Christ.
I think it's certainly probably the most fun he's had in wrestling for a long time. Probably since ECW.
Well, I don't think he would come back if it wasn't fun. You know, because I just don't think he'd do it. And I mean, we started the show with me, I guess, sort of unintentionally panning him. I mean, I really wasn't, because I enjoy this stuff. I think the biggest shame is that he doesn't have a guy that he can really go back and forth with tit for tat, you know, week to week. I actually kind of wish Heyman was an announcer too. That's another thing. Wish he was in the booth. I know some people would probably cringe at that idea, but like if it was up to me, that's what he would be doing. Not to say he wouldn't be managing too, but like I just think it'd be really cool if he was in it. I'm sure he probably wouldn't want to do it, because nobody wants to deal with Vince screaming in their fucking ear. But as a fan,
let's be honest,
totally selfish reasons.
Vince is winding down. Like until he dies, he's going to be a big part of the company. But how much you're impacted by him is probably getting reduced. And I don't know. I actually do have positive feelings about, you know, Hunter in charge. And I think someone like Heyman, like I think Hunter's smart enough to know relying on guys like that is helpful. And whether he has a direct creative role or he has a creative influence, I think he's going to be there for quite a long time. And if he's happy and having a positive creative influence, I think it's fantastic. Honestly,
I gotta tell.
What's that?
Go ahead. Finish your thought.
I was gonna say, who knows how much influence he even has on stuff like the Shield? You know, like.
I would say, I don't want to say none, but I also don't want to say that he has a ton either. I suspect that is an angle that is driven in large part by Ambrose himself, with Rollins' input, and maybe some Reigns too. I suspect that is a idea that they drove in large part on their own.
It is cool to visualize them running ideas by Heyman backstage, though.
Oh, of course. Yeah, absolutely. And I got to say, before we go, I do want to mention this. I really like the idea of, like, Vince Jr.'s, like, last thing that he tells him, like, you know, tells Triple H before he leaves, whether by, you know, death or retirement or whatever. It's sort of like Vince Sr., you know, the sort of story that you always hear, like where Vince Sr. told Vince Jr. that Arnold Skolin always had to have a job for life, kind of, you know, like you can't fuck over Arnie Skolin. That was kind of,
yeah.
I think it would be hilarious if Vince was like, whatever you do, Heyman's got to have a job. You've got to find something for Paul. You've got to.
I actually would picture Vince saying, "You got to make use of Paul, but fuck with him as much as you can."
Yes, I think that's a probably more likely scenario.
I think it's pretty obvious to anyone who has hung in there with us for the past 2 hours and 13 minutes that we're pretty big fans of this guy, and I'm really, really excited about watching him again for years to come. You know, like whatever influence he has on the company, it's really great to have him around.
I actually like him with Curtis Axel, by the way. I mean, I liked him at ringside with Punk. I thought he was an awesome presence at ringside for Punk. But
I liked him during their entrances especially.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I actually think unintentionally, he may actually take away from Punk the act when you're in terms of as a promo, because Punk is such a good promo on his own. Lesnar, obviously, I think he's a big part of and has to help because Brock's not a good mic guy. But Curtis Axel, who I think is actually a very good in-ring wrestler, by the way, I think it's really cool that they're doing this with him. I don't know that it's going to work, but I think it's worth the risk. You know, people shit on it when he came out. It's like, oh, good. But to me, it's like, okay, would you rather have a new guy get the rub? We always get, people get pissed off all the time about this. Like, oh, it's the same old guys over and over again. And then the same fucking people get pissed off when they do something like this. Well, this is them trying to give a chance to a new guy with a guy that can actually talk for them.
Yeah.
Like, you know,
exactly,
I mean, this,
what people have been crying for years.
Exactly. You know, so I'm actually excited.
People might even cry saying, oh, they're just giving it to him because it's a legacy thing. That's a good reason, because that has some drawing power to it, and he is good.
Yes, I agree. I totally agree with that. I don't want to say it's a very good prank, because it's too early to tell, but I think it is a risk worth taking. I'll put it that way.
And I would very much like, as it maybe gets over more with time, to see him add to the stable a bit.
Oh, I actually think that's going to happen. I think there's going to be, I think long term, I don't know if you will ever hear the term Dangerous Alliance again, but I think long term he's going to have some sort of official stable again.
The Heyman Hustlers.
Rip Rogers comes out of retirement.
Yeah.
Oh, that'd be awesome.
Yeah. Well, like literally. You know, we hadn't done the show in a little bit, and I'm very glad we managed to do this tonight. I think we both had the itch to knock off a show. Our last one before this was actually just about a month ago. So it doesn't seem like that long. But, yeah, so I guess not as an official announcement, but we are making efforts towards getting a heavier online presence, I guess. So hopefully that'll work out in the near future. You know, I think we have some timeline issues that we can work on. Perhaps Dylan?
Yes.
You know, like maybe getting things rolling, you know, like that kind of thing.
Maybe so. Maybe that was not very subtle, Dave.
No. basically, I'm waiting on Dylan for some stuff. It's basically exactly what I'm
saying. You know what? All right. Now people, humble listeners, he's put me on the spot, so I will have to do something and start it as soon as I get off the show. Well, actually, I've already started it. I'll have to finish it as soon as I get off the show.
It's because I want to hear your wonderful musings. And this crazy business that we're not actually part of.
This crazy business that we fetishize and talk about for hours at a time on the longest of all wrestling podcasts, the Wrestling Culture Podcast.
We call it the Wrestling Culture Podcast because the culture of mold usually forms on whatever food you've left sitting while you're
on that note, I'm going to go take Dave's not-so-subtle hint, and we will hopefully be back very soon. I'd like to, you know what, I'm going to put you on the spot now. I'd like to do a show maybe, if it's possible, this weekend. If not, in the next week. I'd like to be more prolific for the next month.
Well,
or so.
I think we could easily pop one out this weekend and hopefully be the official launch of
something
big from us. So.
Yes.
Okay.
On that note,
thank you very much, my friend.
A
pleasure as
always.
I'll talk to you later.
I'll probably never talk to Paul Heyman, but I'll talk to you later. So,
okay.
Everybody have a good night.
Yeah. And much like Paul Heyman, we have a very passionate project here that we're just not making money on. So.
Yeah. It's just a hustle.
Yeah.
Good night, everybody.
Good night, bud. Bye.